Hello and welcome back to the There Is a Floodlight That Never Goes Out podcast. As always, I am joined by my sidekick Will, and I'm delighted to say that today we're joined by Joe Devine of TIFO Football. How are you, Joe?
I'm very well, thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm brilliant, apart from the European Super League news, but hey, let's roll with the punches on that one. Kicking off then. Was it always sort of your dream slash career goal to get into the football industry?
No. Shall I expand? I should expand. Not really. No, I wanted to be a musician. That was always my dream. And I accidentally landed in the job I'm in now. I always liked football as a child. I sort of didn't watch it for a few years as a teenager. And then when I left home and was at university, I worked in a pub and there was football on all the time. I watched it loads and, you know, became a sort of, well, I guess I had like advanced fan level knowledge, and met lots of people who were into it, knew a few people who were writing about it for work, and just sort of, you know, accidentally fell into this world.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably going to be my follow-up question. I mean, we've spoke to a lot of guests about how, you know, getting into the football industry, it's something a lot of people want to do, but it's not really a career path often explored. So how did you fall into it?
Well, I got pretty lucky. There was a guy called Alex Netherton who drank in the pub that I worked in, and he was friends with a mutual friend of mine too. And he used to write this blog called Surreal Football about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, something like that now, maybe a bit more, which I always thought was really funny. And he was doing paid work as a freelancer for various different newspapers and different online blogs. And this was around the time when websites were first starting to sort of pay journalists and writers and bloggers and whoever to write columns. And he sort of showed me the ropes and, you know, taught me how to get work, and even got me a few jobs. I did a couple of shifts on the sports desk at ITV very early on. I mean, literally like two or right. three shifts. I hated it. It was terrifying. I was in the, they all work in the same building in central London somewhere. I can't remember exactly where, but they're in there like ITN. They're in there with Channel 4 and Channel 5 as well, I think. And I'd be sat there as the sports guy, supposed to be updating the website at the weekend whenever goals occurred or whenever a big story happened, and there'd be the sort of there'd be the producers of the 6 p.m. news, because they're filmed in the same building as well, would be marching around and shouting at each other and making sure they all had the latest story in this kind of weird bullpen of desks. It was horrifying, so I did it about 3 times and then never went back. But yeah, Alex helped me find my feet really, and then you know, one thing led to another, and I learned how to pitch for work and just sort of snowballed until now.
So I mean, talked about how you weren't really into football as a child, really, but what sort of era do you associate your sort of formative years with? Because we often talk on a podcast here about, we only know modern football.
Yeah.
What sort of era do you associate them years with? Was it early Premier League years, or was it early 2000s? When was that?
There's a gap for me. So like, I remember watching lots of football in the late 90s. I very vividly remember Manchester United's treble. So around that period was the kind of my first, I suppose, formative experience of it. And then I just sort of didn't watch it for about 10 years. Until I started working in this pub again. I mean, I kept up with some of the bigger fixtures, I suppose, in the Champions League, and I always watched the World Cup and the European Championships. But I certainly wasn't an avid football watcher. I didn't have Sky Sports or anything, so I wasn't watching regular Premier League games. And then the second sort of formative era, I guess, I would have been about maybe 20, something like that. And I remember players like Charles Nzogbia and Gabby Agbonlahor. This would have been around 2010. That was when I was really enjoying football. I played a lot of fantasy football then. Some of my friends were into football as well. And, you know, I would sort of spend a lot of time watching it and talking about it. So I would say those two eras, really. But my knowledge in between those two eras is not great. My knowledge before the, you know, late 90s is not brilliant, and it's okay now, but it's not what it was in 2012. That was a peak year for me.
So prior to that, you wouldn't have been considered a legacy fan.
No, and I'm probably still not. Still not a legacy fan now. No, luckily I just work with lots of people who know everything there is to know, so I don't really need to know anything.
Yeah. So sort of moving back onto the career path. I mean, for me, my first sort of knowledge of you on YouTube would be through you, Max It Football, which obviously then later became TIFO. But when did that channel start?
I think about 4 years ago it started. And it started, as you say, as you, Max It Football, because there was this app at the time. I worked for a company who had developed this app anyway. It was a sort of Premier League predictor game. It was called You Max It. And my job was as the social media person. And so I would, you know, do Twitter and Facebook and those sorts of things. And I felt a little bit guilty at the time because it was a full-time job, but there wasn't enough work to do. I mean, there was barely any work to do, basically. So I spent a lot of time trying to make videos and, you know, seeing if we could support the app through content releases in video and trying to use YouTube. And it took a while. Like, I tried a few different types of things, lots of stuff that was a bit funnier and a bit more lighthearted and humorous beforehand, and never really took off. And then I came up with the idea for what TIFO is now, although a much more rudimentary form of it. I guess that probably would have been around 4 years ago. And it just was extremely popular immediately. I think we kind of just found this hole in the market. There were people out there who would be interested in watching this sort of thing. It didn't really exist at the time, and it sort of flew off the shelves, so to speak. So over the course of a couple of years, the company just pivoted its focus so that we worked solely on video, and we got rid of the app. And that's how we found ourselves in conversation with The Athletic when they launched in the UK in 2019. And a year ago this month, they formally acquired us. So TIFO is still a brand in and of itself, but we're now part of The Athletic as a broader media company.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the Athletic revolution, I think it's been in America, and well, at least North America, for a long time now. But how did The Athletic sort of first approach you?
Well, they sort of approached everybody. I think anybody who followed this story in the summer of 2019 will be aware that there are lots of conversations with different journalists. I mean, obviously, we were a slightly different conversation at the time. And initially, we formed a partnership whereby they paid us to, you know, sponsor videos. And we told our audience about their product that was just launching in the UK. But the they approached us, as they did many, many other people. And it was clear through our participation that TIFO was a real asset, and that the sponsorships worked, and that the audience there was a huge crossover of people who wanted to watch our videos but would also be interested in reading the journalism on The Athletic UK. And so the partnership was a very natural one. It just made sense to permanently join forces. And so that's what we did. It's quite funny, though. And I got to go to San Francisco, which we did for two nights, which was a mistake. Retrospectively, I realize now, because the flight is 11 hours and we left on a Friday and came back on a Sunday. And I won't ever do that again, because I think I was so jet lagged when I arrived. I basically, even though I was, you know, falling over, I was so tired, I couldn't sleep when I got to the hotel. It was daytime. We had this, like, absurdly early breakfast meeting with one of the founders of The Athletic. Obviously, he's extremely busy, so he kind of fit us in at 6:30 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think I had about 3 hours sleep the whole weekend. But it was fun. It was a great time.
It sounds like it. sort of modern YouTube then. How do you see the future for TIFO? Like, in your roles change within TIFO over the years. So firstly, probably should you explain that to the listener?
Yeah, I can do. So as I said before, I started as the social media person for the company, and then I came up with the idea for the videos, and over time I sort of crept up and up and up and up until the point now where I'm the most senior employee that Tifo has. I'm the managing editor now. I work with a number of people, including Alex Stewart, who's been around for a long time, as has Seb Stafford-Law, who's our content editor. We have a team of 5 illustrators, there's a few other people there too. So it's kind of, you know, it's grown into this much bigger thing than it was initially. Still a small team, but yes, it's the American dream, isn't it? I went from the bottom to the top.
So in your role, so obviously working at Tifo and with under the Athletic, what are sort of some of the best opportunities that you've found yourself in, while working at Tifo?
That's a good question. Best opportunities, I suppose, would be, well, I mean, the primary one at the moment is having, you know, unregulated access to some of the world's best football journalists. That's really useful, yeah. Given that, as I previously discussed, I don't know that much about football. So if I have a question and I can reach out and ask David Ornstein, for example, and he replies to me, that's great. That's a really good opportunity. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Beyond that, I mean, personally, I would say, aside from the Tifo more broadly, personally, it's really useful for me to understand how businesses work, because prior to this, I'd never worked for a big company before. So I worked at a pub for a long time. I worked for Umaxit for a while too, but we were always a tiny little company. And I don't think I'd ever worked anywhere where there were more than 15 employees. And the Athletic is in comparison is huge. It's not, you know, it doesn't scale in the same way that an enormous multinational corporation does. But there are about 600 full-time employees, and obviously that sort of company works in a very, very different way. I'm working alongside people who definitely deserve to be here for different reasons than I do. You know, like I came up with a clever idea for videos and have quite a good understanding of how YouTube works. And also I'm quite well placed as a bit of a football layman. So I understand what people would want to see because I want to see it. You know, and I can use myself as a sort of parameter for the audience in that way, as an audience. But I work alongside journalists who are extremely experienced and who have been doing this for 20, in some cases 30 years, who know the industry inside out and who I have a lot to learn from, because I, you know, prior to working here, I didn't really have any idea how it all worked. So for a personal professional opportunity, that's been pretty useful.
Yeah. Sort of to follow on Will's question, like, it's something that people always want to know, but what people have you met, like, that people would be like, whoa? Because it's something that I'm always interested in, because it's sort of like when you associate working within football, you associate the glamour and hanging out with Marcus Rashford. And I mean, it's probably a lot more dull than that. It's probably sitting in an office writing. But you know, what glamorous sides of YouTube football is there?
I've done two glamorous things, and I'll happily tell you about them both. I met Ryan Bertrand, the Southampton left back, formerly of Chelsea, and we had a long conversation along with my colleague Alex about football tactics, and he was lovely and really smart, and that was nice. And I've worked with and met several times Ian Wright, and got invited to his party when he came out of the jungle. So that was cool. That was pretty cool. I stood very awkwardly in his house around an awful lot of extremely cool people. And there was a room where they had some handlers with a snake and a big spider. And I sort of left quite early because I didn't know how to talk to anyone. But I was there, and that's my claim to fame.
That's brilliant.
But no, I don't like, I'm not... That's it. But I don't have contacts or anything. I'm not a proper journalist. So whereas all of my colleagues at The Athletic, they wouldn't regale you with these stories because they're professionals. And so there's a sort of privacy aspect to it. They're all way cooler than me in that regard.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sorry, but if you've been invited to Ian Wright's post I'm a celebrity party, and you've got to tell anyone you know and anyone you ever met ever about it.
True. And the longer I tell the story, the fewer people there will have been invited to the party until it was just me and Ian having a nice time playing FIFA.
Yeah. Brilliant. So I mean, let's get into the crux of your own personal football experience. You say you didn't really, you know, fall in love with the game massively at a young age, but was there ever a team you supported?
Yeah, my father was a Manchester United supporter, and lots of my family are Norwich supporters, and so I sort of, you know, flitted between the two, never really seriously supporting any team. And when I came back to football after that, you know, period away from it, I was looking at it professionally mostly at that time. And I found it a lot easier to not really have allegiances. I have a soft spot for both of those teams, but I wouldn't say that I particularly follow either of them. So strictly speaking, I'm not really an ordinary fan in that sense. But I do enjoy the rigmarole of football, and I enjoy, you know, the little moments within games. I really identify with that cliche of it being a bit of a soap opera. I know that TIFO covers a lot of the more, well, I suppose the dry areas of football. We cover a lot of tactics, and we cover the finances and the laws, and we explain how the structures and the systems work, and we don't tend to talk about the soap opera aspect of it very much. But that's what I enjoy about it, because it's, I mean, I think football's so stupid, it's quite, it's just a really silly thing. Mm. And that's the enjoyment that I get out of it.
And sorry, Will,
just, you know, let's say, obviously, when you're making a video for TIFO, could you sort of explain what goes into that? You know, is there kind of, do you discuss it beforehand? Obviously, what you're going to talk about, but is it, you know, do you have a team sort of working on what's going to be said, or is it just you guys who work on it? Sort of, how does it, what goes into making a video for TIFO?
Yeah, so there is an editorial team, which is made up of myself, Seb Stafford-Blaw and Alex Stewart, and we decide what we're going to talk about or what the videos will be about. So for example, our schedule now is booked up until the Euros, so we know all the videos that will be released until June. Mm-hmm. And then we know roughly what we'll be doing until, you know, about halfway through August. So we'll pick the topics, we'll decide who's going to write it. Generally speaking, that'll either be Seb or Alex. Sometimes we'll get outside expertise. So we work with people as well, like a writer called James Montague, who's been around for a long time and is really, really fantastic writer, has a special expertise in several different areas now, but primarily international football. And also he wrote a book called The Billionaires Club, where he sort of profiled football's wealthiest billionaire owners. So he's knows a lot about that area too. And or we'll work with one of the journalists at The Athletic, particularly if they're already writing something that we can convert into a video, that makes life a lot easier too. Mm-hmm. So once it's been decided, it'll go into the calendar, and then the script will be written, generally by just one person, sometimes by more than that, at which point it will go to the design team. And again, like, we have a team of 5 illustrators. Most of the time they all work on a separate project, so it'll be one illustrator that starts and finishes the same video. In some cases, if we need to turn something around quickly, or if it's a particularly big project, we'll have a couple or even 3 illustrators working together on the same video. Yeah. And they'll have roughly 5 or 6 working days to make that, and then it goes to our operations team for a couple of days, and then it is released. So the lifespan of a video, I mean, you know, we can know what it's going to be 2 months before it's released, and then it's made in the space of about roughly, I don't know, 10 days, something like that.
Yeah,
it can be a lot quicker. You know, with the Super League news on Sunday night, we decided it was very important and we needed to cover it. And so we released a short video about 7 p.m. on Monday evening, which had been written in half an hour and then made in about 3.5 hours. And from a design perspective, is quite a lot more sparse, but that's okay because it served its purpose and people seem to like it. But generally speaking, yeah, there's a long lead time that goes into all of these projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think I found it quite funny that you released a video probably 5 or so days ago, titled the cost of sacking Mourinho, and then he gets sacked yesterday. That was pretty good timing.
We're very smart. We really are smart, smart people. We're just quite lucky there. I think everybody knew Mourinho was going to get sacked, didn't they? But we got extraordinarily lucky with the timing of that. The best thing is that it didn't happen before we released the video. That's the most important thing, because then the video is completely useless. So
I was going to ask about lucky. That. I mean, what happens if, you know, let's say you do, let's say in a Mourinho-esque video, but let's say it was titled, I don't know, how much would it cost Man United to sack Solskjaer? And then United sack Solskjaer, what do you do with the video? Will it just go into a vault never to be seen, or what sort of happens?
Well, I mean, the good thing is, like, the individual assets within it, if they've been created specifically for the video. So if one of the illustrators has done four new illustrations of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they don't go in the bin, right? They can be used in another video, and that's okay. The video goes in the bin. It's happened a couple of times. It's very frustrating because it's, you know, days worth of work in some cases and something that's been planned ahead a lot of the time. But it's something we have to think about it a lot because, you know, the Super League news, for example, who knows what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks, but we know that in our calendar we had it in the diary to do a tactical preview for whichever the second of the next two semi-final Champions League games is going to be, and it's the one that includes PSG. Is that PSG Real Madrid? No, who are PSG playing?
PSG Man City.
Yeah, there you go. So we theoretically have a tactical preview for that game. But, you know, I suppose there is a chance that Man City won't be playing in the game. It's not clear what's going to happen. At the moment, I mean, it's unprecedented times. At the moment, we're assuming it's more likely that that game will go ahead. And so we're going to make the video anyway. But there's a chance that that will have to go in the bin. And that will be a sad day for everyone working here.
Yeah. You talk about working with, you know, sort of, as The Athletic would call them, a world-class team of journalists. What is that like? You know, you say it's not obviously on a day-to-day basis that you're around these people, but you said it's brilliant to be around them. Do you pick up, you know, these bits of knowledge off them and then sort of store them away in some sort of memory bank at the back of your head?
I try to do that. Really helpfully, there's a company Slack where there's lots of different channels dedicated mostly to different teams and some to different journalists. And you can read through those under the proviso that you might make a video about something. Basically, you're just curious to see what's going on in the world. I'm afraid to do that too often because what I admire most about these people is their ability to remember what they're allowed to talk about and what they're not allowed to talk about. Because a lot of the stuff, obviously, that comes in, so this is one of the things I've learned about the industry. Journalists have close relationships with many sources within the world of football. And, you know, as I sort of understood from Hollywood beforehand, off the record means something different to on the record, right? So there's a long list of things that they might feed back to an editor when they're working on a particular story, but against half of it they'll say, oh, we can't quote this, well, this isn't to be used, this is just for, you know, background information, etc., so that they can preserve the anonymity of their sources and safety and all the rest of it, and also so they can get the best stories out there. That is the thing I admire the most, to be honest, their ability to remember. You know, particularly with someone like David Ornstein, who we've filmed with on a couple of occasions, and David has this incredible ability to improvise to camera. You know, he works at the BBC, and he obviously did the BBC News, you know, numerous times when he was there, so he's used to this broadcasting environment. But he's so good at just, like, he'll look at his lap, and then he'll look up at the camera, and then just go, and he'll talk for a minute. And he won't mess anything up. And it's amazing. But it's even more amazing when you consider, like, the number of people that he knows, the number of, like, stories that he breaks, how he manages to do that whilst filtering in his head. Can't say that, can say this, can't say that, can say this. Like, it's amazing. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't worked for another massive media organization, but I do have to say that I believe them to be world class.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about David Ornstein there. I mean, guy literally breaks anything that's happening in football, David Ornstein's on it. You know, I remember a time where there was, like, there's thousands of Arsenal fans who just adored him.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of the stranger elements of football where now, in the modern era of the glamorization of transfers, journalists have sort of become celebrities in their own right, like Fabrizio Romano, etc. It's a strange loophole.
He's the other one, isn't he? We should get them to fight in a boxing ring or something. David Ornstein in the blue corner, you know, that would be great.
I'm on the undercard of Jake Paul v KSI Ornstein v Romano.
Exactly.
So you've talked about we've talked about it in little detail, but we've got to ask you about this. We do a football podcast, and we'd be robbing our viewers / listeners of this if we didn't ask you. What are your thoughts on this European Super League?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I can offer that isn't already out there. I mean, I think I tell you what, I watched Monday Night Football on Monday. And I thought the way that Gary Neville talked about it was extremely eloquent. I'm not sure I could ever say anything which would come close to, you know, delivering the same sort of message that he did, or including the same amount of sentiment. But I could agree with what he said, and which the sentiment being that, you know, this is a sort of group of people who have no love for football. And no respect for history or culture or the people, i.e. the supporters who have enabled football to be what it is on the international stage or even just in the UK. They have no love for any of those people or the sport, and they're taking it away in order to make more money. And I know that money thing is a bit of a cliche. I always find it useful. I think that's just because of the way that we try to talk about things internally at TIFO so that we can help explain them in the best way possible. The money point has become a bit of a cliche, because just accusing rich people of wanting to make more money almost is so banal as to mean nothing these days, right? But one really interesting way of putting it is, if you think about what a football brand or a football club is now, it's this enormous company, right? However, they exist in these weird perilous scenarios, unlike most other companies, at least to the same extent, where every year it is possible for them to be relegated from the league that they're in and therefore earn significantly less money. And because the gap has grown ever so greatly between the top and the bottom, even in the UK and in the English football pyramid, for example, being relegated from the Premier League to the Championship is the biggest revenue drop that a football club around the world can experience. That's why they call the Championship playoff game the most valuable game in world football. It literally is.
Yeah.
And that means that when you think about how people make money, that has a huge impact, right? Put the Glazers are a perfect example. They bought Manchester United in 2005 using a financial tool called a leveraged buyout, which essentially, in layman's terms, means that they didn't spend any of their own money when they did it. They borrowed the money from a bank, and then as soon as they bought the club, they put that debt, or they loaded it onto the club. So theoretically, they could just walk away, right? These are people who are used to making money by spending other people's money. They don't spend their own money, they spend other people's money, right? Yeah. And if you extrapolate from that and think, okay, well, therefore they would borrow money. It's a very common thing that football clubs do nowadays, is to borrow money. We've seen Barcelona do it recently, for example, just to cover wage spend during coronavirus. It's happened a lot in the UK as well. It happens sometimes for clubs who want to buy a player outright but pay in stages over a few years. It's a common thing. The problem with that is that when you borrow money, you have interest rates, and interest rates are extremely high when they take into account the fact that any club could theoretically be relegated. If you're a company, or you know, the Premier League, for example, they can't be relegated, so therefore they could borrow money at a significantly lessened interest rate, whereas a football club would have to pay much more interest on the money that they're borrowing because they could be relegated. If you can't be relegated, you can borrow money, a lot more money, a lot more cheaply. And I know that that's obviously not the entire scenario right there, but it's just one kind of small contributing example as to what that sort of banal cliche actually means. There'll be, you know, plenty of other examples like that that, you know, we'll work together to, you know, put the puzzle pieces together to show the whole picture. But that's just kind of one small example of this. So I don't like it. In short, I'm against it, as I imagine most people are. I think it's a hijacking of something which is 150 years old. I think it completely misses the point of sport. It doesn't have any integrity. It doesn't make any sense. I also agree with this sort of slightly more straightforward point that watching these big fixtures would become boring if there was nothing at stake. I think, you know, I think even massive cynical Hollywood films adhere to the concept of stakes mattering. Otherwise, what's the point in watching the film? You know, like, yeah. you need that balance, that counterbalance, for there to be any moment of joy. And yeah, it's obviously just a terrible, terrible idea, and I hope they crumble, and I hope there's also no way back in. And if they were massively punished, even, you know, across the course of a few years, I would support it. And I wouldn't accept any of those clubs coming back into the fold unless a good number of the people responsible for this attempted coup were to stand down. And I would support the government in trying to, you know, explore opportunities for more fan-owned clubs. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this, I know I'm rambling now, but the last thing I'll say is one of the things that's really interesting about this this whole story is that, you know, Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, for example, are sort of being lauded as positive examples of football clubs that haven't joined or have refused it, right? Mark my words, if the 50+1 rule didn't exist and those fans didn't have any say in what their clubs did, those teams would have joined. If they had private ownership, or if the executives had the opportunity to do that, even if it was from a position of weakness where they felt they couldn't be left out of this thing that was happening that they didn't fully support, they would have joined. But they didn't, because they can't. There is no way that Dortmund supporters would allow it to happen. So, like, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be lauded for having that model. I'm just saying that, yeah, it turns out that the 50+1 rule was a great idea. And we should have something like that in the UK and in the other European countries in order to avoid people being able to perpetrate these sorts of actions.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, yourself working within the media, is it more sort of interesting or more hard work when there's stories like the whole thing around the Super League, these big developing stories? Does that make work more interesting, or is it just a lot more hard work?
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like an awkward position to be in, because the last couple of days have been really fun. And obviously, I don't want this to happen. I can understand why it's a bad idea. But it does make it it does make for an interesting week. So it puts you in a bit of an odd position in that sense. However, I think, you know, one of the reasons that it excites me, for example, is because it's an opportunity to actually do something positive. You know, most of the time we'll just... we'll try to do nice positive stories, or we'll try to teach people things they didn't know about football, or bring stories that they might not have heard to them that have a message, for example. But most of the time we just cover Manchester United's tactics as an example, and that's fine. Like, that serves a purpose. People are interested in it, and I'm interested in it, and that's great. It doesn't really do anything for the greater good. So when there's an opportunity to do that, particularly one that is created quite so... you know, mammoth as this, I think that's one of the reasons why it's exciting as well, because there's something that we can do.
Yeah. Well, I think, unless there's anything you really want to add, Tom, I think that's...
We've pretty
much... Can I ask you guys a question?
Of course you
can. Of course.
What's it like to be a sixth former in this sort of time with climate change and with the European Super League? And is it fun? Are you looking forward to the future of the world?
Every dining table in school has become like the Monday night football panel. I'll put it like that. it's just, it's all a bit crazy at the moment, isn't it? We don't really know what's going on in anything, football or exams.
Well, best of luck. I hope we didn't ruin the world for you.
No, there's things to be positive about, I'm sure, but it does seem very depressing at the minute, but I'm sure it'll get better. Thank you very much for coming on, Joe. You've been absolutely brilliant, and can't thank you enough for coming on.
Hey, glad to do it. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. If you're listening on YouTube, please do drop a like on the video and subscribe. If you're listening on Spotify, please do follow us. If you're listening on Apple, subscribe and give us a review. That would be brilliant. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Cheers.